This from Matthew's Gospel, chapter 16, one verse. Then Jesus told his disciples, "If any man would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." More modern translations would say, "If any man or woman should take up his cross or hers and follow." And the sentiments that we put forward in scripture and in song change over time. This is the season of church in the park, 4th of July weekend, other times. For the beauty of the earth, we sometimes worship outdoors in the wonder of celebrating the sun. And in fact, a week from this Wednesday, when KCBD TV from Lubbock is in town highlighting and celebrating Post, Pixie Grisham and a few others are orchestrating a worship experience in the park. Well, the hymn for the beauty of the earth, or This Is My Father's World, are often pieces of music that are chosen for celebrating the sun, picnic in the park, worship at sunset for the beauty of the earth. Hymnals, however, sometimes change the way we sing the song. We have a brand new hymnal, just a couple years old, and the very end of that song, For the Beauty of the Earth, "Lord our God, to thee we raise this our hymn of grateful praise." It's sort of like singing Happy Birthday, right? The original version of that hymn takes the sentiment in a slightly different direction that I think is crucially important. "Lord our God, to thee we raise this our sacrifice of praise," as opposed to hymn of grateful praise. It's more than just a song. The song of gratitude implies a ministry which involves sacrifice. Or, to put it another way, "If anyone would follow me, let him or her take up their cross." In other words, the symbol and reality of sacrifice, and follow me. Take up sacrifice as motivation for ministry. Well, how does that work? I was in Wisconsin for 3 days, kind of a quick trip up and back just to check on the folks, and my folks do not live currently in the home in which I grew up, but that home in which they live has all the stuff that was in it in the home when I grew up. So I'm just sort of perusing, kind of taking inventory here. That's the painting, that's the table, that's the plate. Just a little plate, not an especially valuable or overly sentimental heirloom, just a plate somebody liked once, still does. On a table over in the corner, that's the plate, and suddenly I'm 9 years old, instantly. Bopping through the house, got a ball glove, touch, and somebody can hear the ball hit the glove. And from the other room goes, "Don't throw the ball in the house." And of course, the next sound you hear is that plate falling on the buffet and cracking in half. Well, okay, my dad's pretty handy. I'm learning some skills. So we go downstairs and get out the glue, and the plate goes back together pretty clean. It was just a clean break of two. And if you are on the other side of the room and the light's not bright, you don't see the crack. But of course, you see it when you get up close. And what I know is on the back of the plate, there's a little chip that fell out that we didn't ever get back. So I know, no matter what, that that's the plate that became the consequence of ignoring "don't throw the ball in the house." Now, I would like to be able to tell you that, and now I say this metaphorically, that I have never thrown the ball in the house since learning that lesson. Not true. There have been balls in houses that I have thrown as hard as I could possibly throw to break as much as humanly possible in the effort, on purpose, with malice aforethought, and probably not for the last time. And for the sort of rueful smiles I see out there, I don't think I'm alone in this regard. Right? Which, of course, evokes, at least in retrospect, a sense of guilt. We have done what we know is at least likely to cause trouble. And if it doesn't cause trouble, well, we were lucky and got away with it. But just keep trying, and there will be costs. I've learned to fix broken plates, and yet the scars remain. So it's more than just apology and even trying to put together. It's making amends. It's trying to atone in some way for the losses we have caused. And that's ministry in some way. It's making amends that make our Father's world, if not whole again, at least better than it was before we broke it or broke part of it. Making amends is a hallmark to, among other things, 12-step living, but it's a good way of life to incorporate just as a matter of course. And if not making amends directly to someone who you caused pain, because they may rather not want to see you again, you can make amends to the world. You can make amends to my Father's world. So if anyone would come after me, let them take up their guilt and follow him with resolve, with making amends, with restoring. I also got a notice a couple weeks ago that in September, my graduating class will have a reunion. Now, this is only the second time I've ever got a note about a reunion for my graduating class, which our class graduated decades ago. So it's not an especially cohesive group. And it just so happens that it's not convenient to go, and although I have this sort of voyeuristic curiosity about some of the people that were mean to me in high school and whatever happened to them, there's really no point. It would sort of be like going to a room full of people whose names I heard once and haven't had any contact with since, except one. There's one person in my graduating class. She happens to be my brother-in-law's sister, so I see her once in a while at family gatherings, but that's it. And for another, entirely different reasons. I'm not going to go. But it brings up the larger point, and this occurred to me just out of the blue the other day. I don't have any lifelong friends. That is, people that I have essentially been friends with for my whole life. Now, I have people who are still alive and who I sometimes even run into that were childhood friends. Now, we even have pictures of a couple of them, of the two of us as very small children, infants, really, that grew up for a time, but we've drifted apart. And I would not consider them close friends or even more than just casual acquaintances at this point, which suggests there's a reality of loss in our relationships one with another. There are people that I cared about once deeply that I'm more or less indifferent to now. And it's just on the list of things that we lose as a matter of course. I mean, from the time our goldfish or turtle dies, we learn how to cope with loss. It creates a sense of grief. But out of that sense of grief, and this has become more and more obvious to me, the more obvious it has become over the last couple of decades, that I have lived more years than I will. I have fewer days ahead of me than I do behind me. It makes each day, if I stop to think about it, and I don't always, a little bit more precious. It makes the dear and cherished friendships I have with people I've met since infancy, when I stop to think about it, and I don't always, and I wish I did more of it, all the more precious. So taking up one's cross of grief also means moving forward in a kind of ministry with gratitude, to cherish the moment, knowing they are getting scarce, to cherish the time with people who I love and who love me back. And I have, though not lifelong, dear and cherished friends in my Father's world. If anyone would come after me, let him or her take up their cross of grief and follow with gratitude. On the subject of plates, I think our family's most cherished possession, most cherished physical thing, is a cradle that was built by one in the family, I believe, in the neighborhood of 1880. So it's a very old and precious thing. And there are five generations of babies that have slept in that cradle, at least for a picture, ever since. Well, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, it had fallen into disrepair, and the next baby was soon to be born that would sleep in it. So I said, well, hey, I learned how to fix a broken plate once. We'll try to fix it. And I was brought it back to Wisconsin. My dad and I were downstairs messing with it. And this is a very intricate and, as we soon learned, more brittle than we thought, cradle. So we didn't fix it, and in a couple of ways, we made the problem worse. Fortunately, we have someone else in another facet of the family that is a master carpenter. So we boxed it up, sent it there, waited a while, got it back, perfect. And so life goes on. Now, I would like to be able to tell you that I can do all things, but you know what? I can't. I really have to depend on other people, especially when it comes to craftsmanship. Now, there are some things I can do, and there are a lot of people much more skilled than I, and most do-it-yourself projects that I do myself involve three things: a phone call, a period of waiting, and the writing of a check. Simple. And I have learned that being dependent, even though I'd like to say I can do these all, there's a level of dependence that creates kinship. That's the point. I would like to say I don't need anybody, but I need a lot of people. And that creates kinship. And out of kinship comes understanding, comes growth, comes ministry. If anyone would come after me, let him take up his cross of dependence and follow me with kinship. We all have skills that others need. We don't all have all skills, and that's a good thing, because we wind up working together. Which leads me to this last point. CNN's website had a very provocative headline day before yesterday. It's a question: who will heal America? And that headline comes after yet another week of unconscionable violence in the United States. Who will heal America? Well, it will not be any one person who is holding or running for office that will heal America. It will not be the result of rhetoric. It will certainly not be the result of anything that comes across a Twitter feed. Who will heal America? Not from anyone, but from those many, maybe those many of us, acting as one, doing one thing. Now, Newt Gingrich said something in an interview that got less press than I thought it would, because it was very dramatic and very powerful. Maybe he didn't put it on Twitter, and maybe that's why it didn't get any attention. He said this: "It took me a long time and a number of people talking to me over the years to begin to get a sense of this. If you are a normal white American, the truth is you don't understand being black in America, and you instinctively underestimate the level of discrimination and level of additional risk," said Newt Gingrich, which resonated with me growing up in the 50s. I understood that. Who will heal America? People acting as one, I think, doing one thing. And that is consciously addressing a very difficult question. The question is posed in many different ways, but here's a couple of examples. What's it like, which is an invitation to have someone else speak and you listen, what's it like to be in a town not your own, and across the street are six guys drinking beer, wearing hoodies and low-slung pants? What's it like to be in a city not your home and be across the street from six guys drinking beer in a pickup truck with a Confederate flag? What's it like? It's scary. It's scary for different reasons, but in the same way. If anyone would come after me, let him take up his cross, let her take up her cross of fear. And then what? The hardest thing there is to do in any situation where healing is required, and that is to listen to what it's like, to listen to what it's been like, to listen to what we hope it might someday be. be like. And listening is different than just waiting for your turn to talk with a rehearsed speech or tweet. What's it like to take up your cross of fear? Well, we already know what that's like. If anyone would come after me, Jesus said, let him or her take up their cross of fear and listen and heal America. Amen.